Hello, and welcome to Vision and Voices, a podcast where ordinary people are doing extraordinary work in your community. I'm your host, Crystal Baker Gill. This month, we are acknowledging Memorial Day. Memorial Day is our federally observed holiday where we recognize and honor our military personnel who have died in the performance of their military duties. We want to acknowledge all of our staff, all of those listeners who have served in our United States Armed Forces. Thank you for your service. Our guest today is Joseph Bahota. He is the chaplain of our VOA Carolinas. He has served with our organization for 2 years, but has served in the military for 20 years. He's had 4 combat tours, 3 tours in Iraq, 1 in Afghanistan, and he's been with our organization for 2 years, and he works with our VOA Supportive Services for Veteran Families programs. Chaplain Joe, welcome to the podcast today. I look forward to talking with you and kind of sharing with you and learning a little bit more about your experience and some of the work that you do with our organization currently.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So Chaplain Joe, I want to start with talking about, because we are going to, you know, we're recognizing our military families, our military personnel. Tell me a little bit about what led you to join the military. What was it that kind of started it for you?
Wow. I would love to say it was a sense of calling and adventure and all of that, but it wasn't. If I can be honest, my mom and dad were dirt poor and I couldn't afford going to college. I actually went to college for a half a year. But then I had to drop out because of financial difficulties. I just couldn't afford to keep going. So I was working like 2 minimum wage jobs. And back then, minimum wage wasn't what it is today. So it was even, you know, granted, because of inflation, I guess it was okay. But yeah, the money was not there at all. And basically, all the money I was making was basically just used to like put gas in my car. So I wasn't getting ahead. I wasn't doing anything. And I was like 19. And I actually called the recruiter for the Air Force first. And I was like, hey, would you guys take me? And it turns out I was too overweight. I couldn't get into the Air Force because I was too heavy. No, I was a really chunky teenager. And they wouldn't take me because I was too overweight. So then I went to the Army recruiter, reluctantly did not want to do it. And they said, don't worry about it. We'll run it off you. Come on in. As long as you ain't got flat feet, you're good. So to make a long story short, I joined the Army at 19 and I did 20 years. From that career. Yeah. So joined the Army at 19 and got out at 39. So by the time I got out, over half my life was military years. So when I got back into the civilian world again at 39, I actually had to like retrain what it meant to be a civilian again, because I had more military years than civilian years. So it's been an awesome transition though. And that was 6 years ago. So
I'm sure that's a huge adjustment and it's not an easy thing. Well, you went into the military. What was your specialty?
Yeah, my MOS. I was an 89 Bravo. It used to be called 55 Bravo when I first came in. I was an ammunition specialist. So I was the guy that basically got the bullets for the good guys so we could go shoot the bad guys. And when I became a warrant officer later in my career, I was basically a warrant officer of ammunition. And I was in charge of like the ammunition bunkers in Iraq. So we had all the Hellfire missiles and the rockets and all those cool things you see on CNN, but we're the ones who supplied all that. So yeah, I was in charge of the ammunition bunkers, if you will, when I was in Iraq.
Okay. What did you leave the military? Your title?
I was a CW2 Chief Warrant Officer 2 when I retired. So that was my rank when I got out. I used to be enlisted. I made Staff Sergeant and then I switched over to Warrant Officer and I got out as a CW2 when I finally retired.
Okay, awesome. So you are now the chaplain of our organization.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that was kind of a unique experience, you know, serving God and also, you know, being able to serve in the military and our organization and, you know, for our country. So tell me a little bit about how that meshed, or was it something that happened while you were in the military, or did you start out, you know, as a minister?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a combination of everything. I got licensed as a minister right before I went to Iraq on my first tour. So we're talking around 2003. And I remember my bishop, when he licensed me, he said, you know, I'm licensing you to preach. That way, when you get over there being Iraq, you have no hindrances to preaching the gospel. Because I believed I was going to preach in Iraq. Now, I had no idea I was going to be taking the gospel service over when I got over there. That was something God had for me later. But I got licensed just before I left. And then I got over there and then I preached a Sunday night service. And then the guy who was the pastor, he's like, you know, about 2 months later, he's like, I'm leaving in a couple months. And when I leave, because you only do a tour for a year. So his year was coming up. And he's like, I only got a couple more months here. When I leave, I want you to take the service over. And I had no idea that was going to happen. It was just the favor of God. And so to make a long story short, I became the pastor of the gospel service there in Iraq. Now, fun fact about that is the gospel service was in Saddam Hussein's old movie theater.
Wow.
So, yeah, so this is, here I am, 28 years old, and I'm preaching on the stage of Saddam Hussein's movie theater in Iraq. You know, I'm like, God, taking this 28-year-old kid from Nowhereville, Pennsylvania, and now I'm preaching on Saddam Hussein's movie theater. It's just insane. So I pastored the gospel service over there for about 6 months until my year was over, and then I came home. So I had a little bit of pastoral experience there. And then also on my other tours, I served along with the chaplain as like the assistant pastor and stuff in the other tours that I was on between the four that I was on. So I either was a pastor or assistant pastor or just as a minister who helped out. Now, it's just the grace of God how that worked out. Because again, I'm getting paid to be an ammunition guy. I wasn't a chaplain, but I served as a chaplain, if you will, in the Army with all these veterans. Even though I wasn't officially a chaplain in title, I was an ammunition guy, but I got blessed to basically fill the chaplain role either because there was a shortage of chaplains or the chaplains didn't want to take it because the gospel service wasn't maybe like their tradition that they're used to. So I'm considered like I was like a lay minister according to the Army, but they let, in this particular case, me, the lay minister, be in charge of the gospel service of about 300 soldiers. So yeah, the Lord allowed me to pastor the gospel service, about 300 people. We had some civilians and, you know, civilian contractors and stuff mixed in. So that's kind of where I got started all the way back in, you know, I take it back probably like 2005-ish. And then from there, it just was kind of off and on. And then when I came back, I served at like different places too, in different like civilian churches when I got back to the States, of being like an assistant pastor and stuff when I was like in Hawaii and stuff like that in different parts of the States. So when I came to VOA, it was just like a natural transition. I had pastoral minister experience, but I also had experience with veterans as well because I was a 20-year veteran myself. And I was a pastor of veterans when I was in Iraq. So it was just like the stars were aligned. It was like a fit, and everything just kind of came together. So when they said they needed a chaplain here at VOA in the Carolinas, and you're going to be working with, you know, the veteran population here, I had both on my resume, if you will. So for me, it was just kind of a win-win, and it was just a really easy transition to slide right into it.
So is there a difference in a pastoring or, you know, or ministering to individuals who are at war, you know, during wartime, you're in a tour over outside of the United States in a foreign, you know, foreign country and, you know, pastoring at home, you know, when you're home and you're able and it's a calm environment. What's that like? What's the difference there?
Yes and no. It's similar in the fact that people are people, right? So people have the same needs. They have the same hurts, the same hangups, the same everything. So that part is, yes, it's very much the same. The difference is you don't know if you're going to see tomorrow. Now, granted, you could say that here in the States too, because you just don't know what's going to happen. You get in your car and you can get to an accident on the way home. You mean, you just don't know, but you literally are in a combat zone every day. And so consequently, you don't know what forget about tomorrow. You don't know what the rest of today holds, let alone tomorrow. So because of that, it was such a hunger for the things of God, because people really didn't know if this was going to be their last day on the earth. So as a minister, we took advantage of that, you know, not that we were all about fear-based because we weren't, but we took advantage of that hunger. And we're like, look, I don't care how you come to church. I don't care how you get to God, just get in, right? So we took advantage of that hunger and that thirst for the things of God, because even the ministers didn't know if it was going to be our last day. We didn't know if we were going to get shot. And I have been shot at, and our C-130 was shot at when I arrived in Iraq. And I got a whole horror story about how they tried to shoot our plane down and all that. So we didn't know if we were going to live to see today either. So you take advantage of that. There's such a bond, if you will, that happens with your fellow soldiers, because you're all getting attacked together. So unlike here in the States, you know, you go to church and after church is over, you get in your car and you go your separate ways. And I might never see you until next Sunday. Over there, it's really like a band of brothers and a band of sisters where we come together. And when we come to church, I mean, we throw down and praise and worship God because we don't know if we're going to see each other. So there is a bond there. There is a sharing there. There is a fellowship there and a hunger and thirst there that you may not get here in the States. And it is different too, because you don't have, you know, the strip clubs and you don't have all those temptations that you get here in the States. You kind of get delivered from all that and those distractions. Thank you. And it's just you and God one-on-one, and you and your fellow man and fellow woman one-on-one. And you can really, really develop, if you want to, really develop your relationship with the Lord in that wilderness, if you will, because literally God and your fellow man and woman is all you have. Unlike here, you have so, you know, so many distractions, but over there, all that's taken away from you. You're literally stripped down to the basics in the wilderness. And that's where you really can be tried by fire, if you will.
And I can imagine some of people seeking you out for help, you know, when they're dealing with some of those challenges that they're facing over there. I can imagine Absolutely. Those were probably some heartfelt, you know, conversations.
Oh, absolutely. Whether it be, you know, death or suicide, right. taking their own life, or God, you know, one of the number one things, at least for the men over there, was sexual temptation. And, you know, help me, brother, not to cheat on my wife. You know, which is legit. I mean, it's, you're away from your spouse for a whole year, right? So just that whole, and then you're getting shot at, and then the depression and the anxiety and the stress and the nerves, and you ain't got, you know, your spouse ain't there to, you know, to comfort you. And you, so how do you deal with all this? And God knows your kids and the stress of your kids, and you can't see your kids for a year. I mean, we had people that when they left, their kid was one, and then they come back, their kid is two, and their two-year-old kid doesn't even recognize them. You know, so like, it's like they come home and it's like, my kid doesn't know who I am, you know, those type of things. So yeah, there's a lot of stressors that you don't get back in the States.
So let's talk about that. You went to my next question. You're talking about the challenges of the person being away, right. you know, overseas, then coming home. Yeah. And, you know, the challenges that they then face when they have to, you know, now kind of adjust to being home again. You know, right. they've been away so long and, you know, everything is different, you know, when you come back.
Well, everything is. I mean, first of all, your spouse is different. They've literally learned how to help hold down the fort without you. So we tell people now, thankfully the military, they have classes on this when you come, you know, coming home classes and resiliency classes, and they give you training on this. So when you go home, you can kind of know what to expect, and they tell you, don't think it's going to be the same and you're just going to get right back into it like you always done it, because it ain't going to be that way. Your spouse has changed. He or she has learned to hold down the fort without you, and they did it well. And so a lot of those tasks and roles that you may have been doing, well, mama or daddy's been doing them for the last year, and now you may have to slowly, surely get back into those roles because your spouse has been holding it down for a whole year. Two, your kids may not recognize you if they're really young. So you have to ease back in, particularly if it's the disciplinarian role. It's like, well, mama or daddy's been that person the whole time. So now, you know, who are you, this foreigner coming in trying to discipline these kids, and they don't know who you are. So you have to deal with that. Also, too, just the whole, you know, when you're in combat, you have this always ready, all, you know, always, you know, attention to detail, always your head is always on a swivel type of thing. So not only do you have the PTSD aspect where you may have that, but also just the fact of always on the go, and I got to do something. You know, I have a mission. I got this, and I got down. I have duties and responsibilities, and I got a mission. And then you come home and you tell them to relax. And they're like, I'm bored. I need something to do. I can't sit down. I can't sit still. I'm restless. There's got to be something going on. And they're like, you know, what do you mean? Or like we just talked about, you know, they come home and all these distractions are hitting them in the face again. And so do I do it or not do it? And do I go down that road? Do I not go down that road? Because I was, you know, for a whole year, I was separated from that, but now I can go back to that. So do I really want that? You know, what, for instance, might be the bottom, might be alcohol. You know, you're not allowed alcohol over there when you're a soldier. So now you come home and now alcohol is there. So, that, you know, I just proved to myself I didn't need it for a whole year, but now that it's here. So now do I binge, and now do I just go hog wild and, you know, get so passed out that I almost get, you know, liver cancer, or, you know, I get alcohol poisoning because I just want to do a whole year of binging, you know, then to kind of make up for lost time or whatever. So there's this, all these things that you have to process when you come home. And so even your job is different, even as a soldier, because there's a difference between training for war and being in war itself. So now, you know, when you come home, you know, you're not doing combat missions. You're not doing the same military job you did over there. So your job is different. Your spouse is different. Your kids are different. Your mentality is different, because not only did they change, but you changed too, because you progressed a whole year away from them. So you're a different person. So you literally have to, you know, there's an old song, you know, reunited and it feels so good. But sometimes it don't, because they're different. You're different. The kids are different. Your job is different. Everything's different. And you have to ease into it slowly to get back into it.
And I can imagine with some of the individuals who may have experienced loss, you know, and then having to deal with that, the loss that they had of people that they work with, they saw every day.
Right. Yeah. Survivor's remorse. It's like, God, why did you allow me to come back and they didn't? you know, how come I survived that IED attack and they didn't? Or, you know, how come I came back with all my faculties? My buddy, he lived or she lived, but they have no legs now. They have no arms now, or they're severely burned. It's like, God, how come I came back with? And so you may ask, I might, God, not have any physical scars, but I have emotional scars. I have mental scars because, God, how come they have all those physical outward things? And then me, I ain't got no scratch on me, but yet, so there might be guilt there and there might be shame there or whatever. So you're like, God, why did you allow this to happen? You know, and how come I lived? And, you know, and God, what am I supposed to do about it? Like, am I supposed to live this great grand life because you allow me to live? Like, what am I supposed to be doing with my life now? What is the purpose of my life? Because God, for some reason, you allowed me to live it. So what do you want me to do while I'm here? So you have all these questions, you know, it's more than just, okay, what kind of mayonnaise do I get at the grocery store? This, you know, what kind of salad dressing do I get? Right. These are way bigger questions than that. You know, it's like, what is the purpose of my life? And God, why did you allow me to live? And how come you allowed them to die? And, you know, that was my best friend and all these type of things.
Yeah. So that's, and I know our organization, one of our initiatives is moral injury.
Right.
And, you know, in the thought or, you know, the feeling that individual feels that they've actually feel that guilt, you know, for, as you mentioned, for not having gone through some of the things that someone else has gone or right. witnessing some of those things. So I know that's an initiative that you guys are working on there in the Carolinas. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, what we're trying to do is get moral injury off the ground here in the Carolinas. And what I want to do, or what we want to do, is because I'm a former veteran, is basically have me start a peer group here in the Carolinas with the Maple Court program, where we basically start with the veterans here at Maple Court, with the homeless veterans, to start a moral injury peer group within Maple Court here with the 24 residents that are here. And then through that, I'll be a trainer. And then what I'd like to do is then take the training that I received and basically be a train the trainer for other people. So if there's anybody else in VOA, not just here in the Carolinas, but all through Chesapeake and the Carolinas, who want to be able to train in moral injury, and so they can facilitate their own peer groups, or if they just want to be a trainer themselves, I can train them as a trainer, if you will, so they could be trained in moral injury and they could go ahead and minister to that type of training for those people as well. Because moral injury is more than just what happens to veterans. It's moral injury is for anybody. It's basically anytime you experience something or got hurt or you experienced some kind of a trauma in your life where it violated your conscience or violated your moral ethical code. And, you know, how do you process that? And how do you deal with it? Whether you were sexually abused or any kind of abuse or any kind of trauma that you suffered, how are you processing that? You know, you suffered something in your soul, and therefore, how does your soul process the pain? You know, how does it process the hurt? How does it process the baggage? So yeah, moral injury can affect or can treat or help all these areas. So I'm trying to start off with the veterans first, because obviously I'm a veteran, but moral injury breaks off into many different, you know, avenues of civilian life as well.
Absolutely. One of the things I know with our healing conversations, we focus in on how moral injury affects us, you know, with the issues that we're facing with racism, you know, that individuals face, you know, every day. You know, that is a moral injury. That is, you know, the hurt that a person feels, the guilt that some may feel because of what they have experienced or how they respond or react in certain situations.
Absolutely.
So yeah, those are, you know, definitely moral injury definitely surpasses just, you know, individuals who are in the military. It's something that we have to look at on a regular basis. So, you know, and I applaud you guys, your efforts that you guys have there in the Carolinas to branch out and to help to grow that initiative. I want to kind of change up a little bit here.
Sure.
I know you are married.
I am.
And you, and correct me if I'm wrong, a process of adopting.
Well, yeah, we have two foster kids.
Okay.
We would adopt them if we could.
Okay.
But as you know, in the foster care arena, the goal is reunification of their biological parents or
right.
a family member. In this case, it looks like, well, let me just go ahead and say, we got two foster children right now, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. So yeah, that was a big transition for our family and my wife and our challenges, but it's been rewarding too. We have a 4-year-old and two boys, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and they've been with us since November of last year. So we've had them now for about 6 months. And of course, we've fallen in love with them and they're just amazing kids. But yeah, they did find a family member in Texas. So it looks like they're going to be reunited with them. So it is looking like we will have to give them up in the next couple months or so. But yes, we would love to adopt them. So when that day comes, I'm going to have to hug my wife a lot because she's going to be... Yeah. Crying immensely, and me too, but it's going to be a very heartbreaking experience. But that's part of the foster care system or the plan that they have. When you go into it, they prepare you for that. They tell you this is how it can be or how it's going to be. So you got to be emotionally and mentally ready for that. But I don't really think you can prepare for that kind of thing. You just, even though you know about it, but when the day hits, it's different. But yeah, they do train you and tell you, you know, reunification with the parents is the goal.
And that seems like it changes every day. And unfortunately, I know when I spoke with you last, that wasn't the case. So
right.
This
thing is new. It just came down about 2 weeks ago. Wow. We actually, last week, we had a meeting with all the case managers and mm-hmm. all the social care workers and everybody. So there's like 10 people on the call. And they said, yeah, this is happening. This is what's going on. And I was in the meeting with my wife and it's like, okay, this is where we are. So it is unfortunate, at least for us, but it's just part of the system. So that's what we're going to do.
And do you think you guys will continue to, you know, foster more children?
Probably. Well, we're still looking to adopt. That was always our goal. We want to extend our family. So for me and my wife, that has always been our goal. And here in North Carolina, I don't know how it is for other states, but when you go through the program, you can do foster only, or you can do foster to adopt. And we went through the foster to adopt part, and because that was always our goal. So hopefully we can get some more and adopt. That's what we want to do. It really depends on how we feel after we have to give these two boys up. If it's really an emotional train wreck for us, we probably won't do it. But if we have the chance to adopt, then we probably will, because that was always our goal. But yeah, we always believed in, you know, helping out, and we want to give kids the best home they possibly can either way, whether it's foster or adoption. So even though these kids have only been with us for 6 months and they may be with us only a couple more months, the two that we have now, we can get some reprieve or some knowledge that for the 8 months they were with us, you know, they were blessed. Right. So, you know, that makes me feel good for that. The fact that, you know, the Lord blessed us to be a blessing. So, you know, the fact that we could open up our home and bless these two little ones, you know, that's pretty good. But yeah, if we can adopt, we definitely want.
How difficult was it for you and your wife to kind of get involved in the foster care system? Because I know this is something that, you know, we definitely have a lot of children out there that need loving families and individuals to support them. Was it challenging getting involved?
Yes and no. It wasn't challenging as far as hard, but it was challenging as far as all the work you got to do. Here in North Carolina, you got to go through classes, whether it be a 5-week course or a 10-week course. And you have like 5 weeks if you do it like on 5 Saturdays, or you do it like on 10 weeks. And we went through the 10-week course, depending on the foster care system that you go through. And then even after that, then you got to go through like all this paperwork. And it goes like all the way back to like you're 4 years old until now, and tell us little, every minute little detail that you ever done in the history of your life. It all has to be documented, you know, how your parents raised you and everything about your education and your employment and the money you make and everything. So you have all of that until you are now. So the paperwork took like 3 or 4 months to get through on top of the 10 weeks you have to go through. And then, you know, not every child that comes through is a fit for you. Right. So like some children, it may not be a fit for your family. So you have to say no, unfortunately. So it took almost a year just to get these two kids that we have. So we were in the system for about a year and a half before we got our placement. So yeah, it's challenging with all the work you got to do. And then you got to take classes even after you get kids, because you have to stay current. So yeah, it's not hard, but it's just challenging because all the work and preparation you have to do to get kids.
And then the period of time that it takes, I guess, yeah, right. It seems like it's forever that you're waiting. And unfortunately, then you can go into a situation like you're facing now. But the great thing is these children have experienced you guys through this time where they may have been in a different situation. So they got to experience love.
Absolutely. And hopefully we get to see them later. You know, we're still got all their photos on our phone. So we get to see them later, and we can, you know, when they're in their 20s or something, but hopefully we can see them later. Yeah.
Yeah. And you'll kind of see how you were able to feed into their life and kind of help them to grow. So that's a blessing. So I'll go back into your work that you're doing with Volunteers of America, Chesapeake and Carolinas as a chaplain. So we're talking about you guys there, you're working with the veterans in that area. What would you say? And I know it's a large population of veterans. You guys have 24, you said, that are in that program?
Just in Durham. That's just the Maple Court program. And that's like the apartment complex that houses the homeless veterans. But we got different offices all throughout North Carolina, not just in Durham, but also Rocky Mount, Salisbury, and Fayetteville. So our base is pretty spread out throughout North Carolina.
one of the challenges that many of the veterans in that program and also in our program here in the Virginia area is homelessness. You know, we have veterans who have come back from serving their country and they come back and now they can't find a job. You know, they're out of the military, they can't find a job. And they're, you know, unfortunately they fall on hard times. And they're homeless. So I would imagine that's a challenge, trying to work with individuals and kind of minister, you know, to them through that experience. How difficult is that?
That's a challenge too, because like you said, when they come to us, you know, they're homeless for a reason. Like we talked about earlier, you know, they may have come back, couldn't find a job. And there's reasons for that. One, because these severe PTSD. The other one could be, you know, just severe mental health, because maybe there was something that happened over there that you just mentally can't cope, or something happened where it is a moral injury and you have a trauma mentally. Uh-huh. Also, you could have a disability. I mean, maybe you had an arm or a leg blown off. So now there's some kind of disability that's enabling you from doing the job that you used to do. And now you have to start over and maybe try to do something else. So now you have to suffer the loss of not just of maybe your buddy, but now you have to suffer the loss of your own person, where you don't have the life of quality of life you used to have. So now you have to grieve your limbs and grieve the quality of life that you used to have. And now you don't, which can lead to all kinds of other problems, like, you know, alcoholism. And so you turn to the bottle, or you turn to drugs, or you turn to other things to kind of numb the pain. So now you have alcoholism, you got opiates, you have all these different abuses of drugs and things to try to deal and try to process with all that stuff that happened to you. So not only do you have unemployment, but now you have drug issues, or you have alcohol issues, or because of that, maybe you did something stupid and, you know, you committed a crime, or you had domestic violence and your husband or your wife kicked you out because you were violent in your drunken state or whatever. So now you have domestic violence issues and violent issues or whatever. So when you put all of that together, it's just like a huge melting pot of just stuff that happened to these veterans, and they served our country. And yet they came home, and either because of lack of care or knowing how to deal with it, you know, or as they teach you in the military, you know, take some Motrin and drink water, you're good. And that's not, we're not always good.
Right.
So consequently, so they don't drink water, they drink alcohol instead, and they get really tore up. And then now you have all these issues that come with it. So it is challenging, because you have to try to wade through the water of all that stuff before you can really get to the soul of a person. So sometimes it is harder, because, you know, you have to get through all that baggage before you can get to the heart of the issue.
Yeah. Through that program, we offer the case management services. You know, we deal with mental health services, as you mentioned, you know, and, you know, kind of work through the challenges through recovery, you know, as you mentioned with some of them. But being able to also provide that pastoral care, I think, mm-hmm. is an element that, you know, kind of sets our program aside from, you know, another program that they may be a part of. So, you know, that's, and kudos to you for being there and being able to share with them. So that's definitely a blessing to have that, because sometimes that's what it takes to kind of work, you know, them through those other challenges.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I tell everybody in the new hire orientation is, you know, what we try to do is like that old Proverbs that says, if you give a person a fish, he'll eat for a day. But if you teach mm-hmm. them how to fish, they'll eat for a lifetime.
That's right.
And that's what we want to do here, is to give them the 100% wholeness and fullness of recovery, body, soul, and spirit. Right. We try to minister to the whole person. And that way we can give them the tools and materials and skills to where, you know, when they leave our presence, hopefully it's just not teach them how to fish for today, if you will, but it's to give them what they need so they can be successful for the rest of their life. And I think the spiritual component is very, very key to that, because like you said, it's not just here's some pamphlets, here's some material, but let me minister to your soul so your soul can get, you know, renewed and restored and blessed or what have you. So when you leave us, you know, you can eat for a lifetime type of thing.
That's one of my favorite quotes as well. Thank you, Chaplain Joe, for joining us on Vision and Voices. I've really enjoyed the time that we're able to share and talk about some of the experiences that you've had, some of the experiences that our veterans, you know, may have had, and that connection, you know, bringing faith and ministry to our individuals who've served, you know, our military personnel. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So thank you for joining us again on Vision and Voices, a podcast where ordinary people are doing extraordinary work in your community. I'm your host, Crystal Baker Gill. Learn more about the work that we do at Volunteers America Chesapeake and Carolinas and our supportive service for veteran families on voachesapeake.org. Hear this podcast and others like it on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.